Welcome back, everybody. Let's start with an announcement.
Hi, my name is Leha Goh. I'm with the organizing committee for this year's global conference on Buddhism. So you've heard just now a few mention of speakers who would be here. There's Bernard Carr, Dharma Ruan, that was so talked about just now. We've got Danny Shepherd, who is a hypnotist. And we've got Ajahn Brahmali, Bante Sujato, Venerable Hasapanya. She's not here, but she's one of the speakers as well. She's over there. And, of course, Ajahn Brahm. So we have 24. In fact, we've just added another one. So we've got 25 amazing speakers. And we're selling tickets right here in the hall over there at a discount. So for those of you who have not bought tickets, please get your tickets today. And if you have any questions, there are a few of us from the organizing committee who is here. So feel free to approach us. Thanks, man.
It should be great fun. One of the people that I'm doing a talk with is a cyborg. One of them is growing an ear on his arm, and another one is growing his own brain in a jar. So that should be fun. And then there's a robot as well. So, yeah, that should be a little bit, something a little bit different. Okay. Thank you so much. So for the next session, we're going to spend about half an hour of the session with Dennis and a few other friends, and we're going to be talking about Dennis's work in hypnotherapy and hypnotic regression. Hopefully Dennis doesn't need too much of an introduction for you. Dennis Shepherd, past president, a.k.a. chief troublemaker at the BSWA. And somebody who has quite a lot of experience with this area of hypnotic regression and so on. So anyway, take it away, Dennis. And just to say that, you know, we're interested to hear what your experiences are and feelings are from having dealt with a lot of people doing these regressions. And in particular, what are the things that make a difference to you to feel like there's something going on here? Is this something people are making up? Is this something that's true? Or what difference does that make? And how does that actually affect any kind of therapeutic outcome? Yeah. Anyway.
Good. Well, first of all, probably I maybe just give everybody an idea just of what hypnosis is, because you know, I believe, without going too far into it, that we are basically all hypnotized all the time anyway. we have this dissociation that is kind of a hallmark of humanity, really. Perhaps we can talk about that a little bit more later on, just to make that a little bit more clear. But in actual fact, hypnosis itself is a process of dissociating. So we dissociate, or we attempt to dissociate the conscious mind from the subconscious mind, with the idea that the subconscious mind really has a lot of information there about all of us. In my terms, it sort of has a direct contact into the conscious field of the universe, in fact. But we all have a subconscious mind, and that subconscious mind sort of exists without us knowing. There's really just the conscious, but you can see a little bit like an iceberg. The iceberg just has the tip poking out of the top, and that's really what we all know consciously. But as we all know, is that underneath we have these subconscious pushes and pulls that are moving us in all sorts of directions and taking us in places that we aren't consciously aware that it's taking us to. And we all have that. We have this big, vast area of subconscious information. I mean, you can maybe even just think about this as you're driving, learning to drive a car is a very conscious thing when you're learning to drive it. But once you've learnt it, the whole process becomes subconscious. So when you're driving a car after some experience, you don't even think about what you're doing. You just do it. And that's really what is there subconsciously. Now, we dissociate the conscious from the subconscious mind by doing three things. Or we can do it in three ways. We either bore the conscious mind into moving away from itself, or we confuse the conscious mind so that it's sort of off dealing with the confusion, or we shock it, And that's an interesting thing in itself, just to when any person is in a state of shock, they are in a hypnotized state. So it's just probably a very good thing to know if ever you come across anyone on the side of a road that's been in a car accident or something like that. You can sometimes do a lot of good just by understanding that that person is in a state of shock and is in a hypnotized state. So if they're, you know, maybe even, you know, pumping out a lot of blood or something like that, you can say, stop the blood, stop the blood. And subconsciously, the body will kind of react to that. So that's kind of a little bit of how we do it. But the thing is, in all the people that I've seen a lot of people over the years that I've been learning this, since 2004, there's a certain group of people that you can really, you really know that they believe what they're talking about. And indeed, I've had the experience of having one person that's that really the story that they told was just so precise and so you know, measurable with dates and times and everything, that when he, and this person had the wherewithal to check up all the facts too, and when he did, this past life that he had, of course, fell out of the record like a stone. It was just amazing, just astonishing actually to see it. This person even has the ability to go and visit his own grave and his past wife's grave and various other things. So it can be quite unnerving, really, I suppose, when that sort of thing happens. You just sort of, you see it happen. But then, coming back from that, there's a whole group of people that are able to measure past lives, and of course they move away from my office, and maybe it's still in a little doubt, you know, is what I'm saying true or not true? You know, did that really happen? Is it really a past life or not? And that's probably always going to be a problem. I can remember Venerable Santuti once saying to me, he wanted to come and have a hypnosis session, but he said, but if I come and have a session with you, am I going to believe it? Yeah, well, I'm afraid you can't really do much about that. But there are things, I think, though, that you can that help the people themselves believe what's there. I mean, I've, there's a few people in this room that have been to me, and maybe that might be a good opportunity, perhaps, just to, because I've just actually spoken with Alan, and he's very happy to just share this situation, because he had quite an astonishing past life. And could we have a microphone to Alan? Perhaps he can just tell you a little bit about it and tell you about his experience, and then we're going to move on to Venerable Chaga, who came to me last week. In fact, these two venerables here, they're both pretty gung-ho, you know, with this kind of thing. You know, well, Venerable Chaga's willing, you know, we'll do a live session in front of you all. But, you know, for a start, usually these sessions take a long time. It's 2 to 3 hours, and they can be quite tedious, too, sometimes. It's, you know, just getting the information out and sort of finding the right way to do it. But at any rate, we had relative success in a quite short time, really, with Venerable Chaga. He's going to come back and finalise the session, but we do have a little video that we can show you that I made of the session, and he'll be able to tell you something about that too. But Alan, perhaps you could just tell you a little bit, I don't know how much you want to reveal about your story, but...
Just a little background for everybody. I've been in Buddhism for 22 years, and the first time I heard about reincarnation was when I was in the Tibetan tradition, and I said, no way. And so, in fact, when I decided to go to hypnotism, I was an open mind. I said, okay, let's be curious about it. Let's see what's there. The experience was amazing. And I have a very vivid memory of it. Even you record it for me, you gave me the... and I never listened to it because I don't need... I really have it totally in me. And the thing which was already astounding for me is that I could have such a memory of an event which occurred somewhere, I think, in Europe, in the Middle Age, 11th, 12th century. And I found myself running away in the middle of the night in a forest, and suddenly knights arrive on with their armor and sword and all the rest, and I knew it was the end of me. And there was an image of this young girl in the donjon, you see, of the castle, yeah. And I associated my fate with something I did with this girl. which I was not supposed to do, I suppose.
Sex goes back a long way.
Yes. So, of course, I could not trust this story to see if it is true and to relate to any past life. But the fact that I had this kind of memory, which I could not invent, there was no basis for me to invent this kind of story. So I came out of this session, not straight away, but progressively, started to say, yes, there is maybe some ground into this concept of rebirth. And then I did a lot of study and investigation on my own and discovered Professor Stevenson, read several books of him and so on. And now today, for me, it's totally, absolutely no question about that. Rebirth is a as Jean Bram says, it's a scientific fact. It's no question. So this session with Dennis has been, for me, very useful to see that, yes, it's possible in some situation to have memory about very old past events. So I do believe now what the Buddha says, that in the night of his enlightenment, he remembered plenty of past lives. And in fact, I'm looking forward to this time.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you so much. Yeah, very good. I don't know if you want to stay here. There might be some more questions later, yeah. but Dennis.
Yeah, yeah, so the stories that come are kind of very varied in many, you know, and there's varied in many ways of, I was just sort of listing a set of themes, you know, like from being attacked by other villagers, you know, that figures, you know, quite often you get criticism of this, oh, everybody's Cleopatra, or, you know, you get this criticism that says, oh, yeah, everybody wants to be, the Caesar or someone like that, but I find that it's very rarely like that. In fact, most lives, when they're really thought about, sometimes they're really quite miserable and very ordinary oftentimes too. But quite often the lives where people are left for dead or they're in very impoverished circumstances and, you know, there's really so much. I can just remember a lady who I think it must have been part of the potato famine, who, as a young girl, just at 16, describing how she was left to die on the floor of a house because her parents had somehow left her. It was, you know, through no fault of the parents, really, either, but just a situation, you know, like that. That's very, very heart-wrenching, actually, too, but in many cases, though, as it was in this case, a complete answer for this woman for all the, for this particular resonance that she had going on in her life. I mean, this woman, just remembering when she came to me, she came from a good family, you know, very, had everything that she would want. She was in her 50s probably, but couldn't understand why with all the good parts, the good things that she had in her life, she couldn't understand why that she'd been, feeling this suicidal tendency since she was a little girl. And it had followed her through. I mean, she was living with it, but just this miserable suicidal thoughts that would sort of plague, you know, what otherwise was a very good life. So to actually go back and see, you know, see the resonance that came from this life was really quite something for her. You know, and then you get people that are like church always figures big in church, and people that keep records for churches and things like that. There seems to be always trouble around that. Religious artefacts and also the burden of oaths, you know, when someone takes an oath, how that kind of goes in somehow and really can stay over lifetimes. It's just amazing.
So that's, I mean, just to break in, but that's quite an important part in Buddhist idea, isn't it? That you make a sort of a vow to practice in future lives and so on.
Yeah, you can turn it positively. Turn it positively, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Which obviously the boy chanter there probably has done. But just people embodying themselves as animals, or people lost in the bush, you know, certainly past family abuses, and just what comes through into the future, which can be good and bad. You know, it's really just amazing. And I've written down here, advisors at court. You get lots of people seem to want to are able to do that. Witches, certainly lots of, and then. You know, and just the burning of witches, you know, that sort of thing, and the oppression that women in past times felt, you know, that's seems to figure quite well. I can remember one particular life I had. It's amazing how the brain kind of plays around with these things. I'm just thinking of this one case that I had where. The lady started off playing with gorillas. You know, I thought it was going to be a gorillas in the mist thing. You know, she was sort of patting gorillas and playing with gorillas. But in actual fact, it very quickly went on from sort of playing with gorillas to her being in a in an army camp and in a gorilla camp in Africa, and then going on from there into a situation of war. So the brain or the mind seems to have this this capacity to use metaphor, you know, in that way, where you know, it starts off with a playful thing with a gorilla, you know, but the gorilla ends up as a guerrilla warfare, you know, that's really where we're heading to. So that sort of thing happens, that resonance seems to happen quite a lot. And then, you know, of course, finding your place in the universe, and when you're rejected, pain is a big thing. And, you know, I've had quite a few people that have come to me with pains in their body. I can remember one lady that came. Well, actually, she's a young girl. In fact, this lady was a referral from Heidi, who does kinesiology. But she saw this this girl and sent her on to me because Heidi suspected that there might have been a past life involvement with her, because she had this pain in the stomach and it had been getting worse and worse for a year, and she was on quite heavy Panadol treatment each day now to try and control that pain, and. She'd been to the doctors and everything. There's nothing medical that was wrong with her at all. It seemed to be just psychosomatic. But at any rate, when we did a past life, she remembered this life of sitting on a fence. She could remember a little girl, and, you know, a beautiful little girl with ringlets in her hair, and usually very vivid, the memories. And then a man coming, and the dread. You could feel the dread in her as this man was approaching, and of course he. Because this was this girl, she was very young, so I had a mother sitting with me too. So, because I haven't got a police clearance yet to sort of be with children, and it was really quite a harrowing thing. Yeah, this girl, she didn't really describe it that much, but it was sort of left in no detail with no doubt about what had happened. But her mother being there, I don't think she could explain too much. But it was fairly clear that she was raped and murdered and left in the bush. And then she was found by her mother in that life later on. But as it turned out, because it might be a good point just to tell you how I do this process too, which I think is a wonderful way to do it, because I do what we call a Dolores Cannon method. And that is people come along with a presenting problem usually. There's some sort of issue that they're looking at that they would like to have resolved or fixed. So that's clarified very clearly for a start. We sort of set out some questions that we're going to ask the subconscious mind to resolve. And then we do the hypnosis. And the stories that come out of the hypnosis can be anything. You know, like sometimes I'm thinking, well, what has this got to do with these questions? It's got absolutely nothing to do with anything. I'm thinking that. But then afterwards, when we've finished the session and we've got the stories down, then I take them deeper into a deeper trance and ask then for their subconscious mind, asking permission first of all to speak with the subconscious mind, and then asking the subconscious mind to explain what the stories mean, which invariably they do. It's just it's astonishing actually just how you know, a story that I think is just, you know, how does it even connect? And then somehow or other, the explanation from the subconscious mind connects, and it's really quite amazing how that works. And with this girl, I did the same thing, asked her, if the subconscious mind could help with the pain first of all I asked her, is the pain got anything to do with the story you told? And she said yes. And I said to her, how long will, can you fix it? Can you help it? And she said, yes, I think so. And then I said, how long will it take for the subconscious mind to be able to help? And she said, she was vague, and then I said, what would it be, days, weeks, or months? And she said, probably months. And I said, will you be able to fix it? And she said, yes. And then, as it turns out, 3 weeks later, I had her auntie came to me. And so that's how I knew about this girl. But within 3 weeks, all her pain had started to abate. So, you know, just quite amazing that this pain that she was using Panadol for nearly a year, quite large doses of it, to keep under control, was just able to be reconciled. So,
sorry, Dennis, to interrupt once more, but that's an interesting detail. You're getting the unconscious to interpret the unconscious for you, which is quite different from normal therapy, where you have the unconscious imagery or whatever, and then the conscious mind tries to interpret it, and of course always struggles to do so. But if you ask for the unconscious's help, then that's obviously a much easier way of going about it, I would have thought.
Yeah. Well, it is, and the other good thing that it does is that it keeps me out of it. You know, like I'm you know, I guess that resonates with me because I did spend quite a few years, 22 years, in fact, with the Samaritans, where I kind of learnt how to listen. You know, Samaritans are a wonderful therapy they have there for working with suicidal people. You know, and that's really for all of us, I think, just to really learn, and it's good meditation too, just to learn how to listen, just to really listen to somebody, because it's very rare that we actually do that. We actually do really listen to somebody. But when you can really listen, it's just a terrific therapy for, you know, the people that came to Samaritans. They would be people that had been to all the doctors, they'd been everywhere else, and they were really just at the last port of call. And we had nothing to offer in the way of medicine or anything like that, only just a listening ear. So that's, you know, I'm always eternally grateful to the Samaritans for teaching me and being able to sort of learn that method from them. And sort of that's really what followed through into the hypnosis practice. So when I found Dolores, because Dolores in many other ways, Dolores Cannon, her method is, it's not something that I would naturally resonate with. In fact, it was Heidi that sort of booked me in to her course when she first came, because I thought she was a bit of a weirdo. And, because, you know, some of her books are really quite out there, you know, the teachings of Nostradamus and all this sort of stuff. But she was a wonderful woman. You know, when I saw her, she was 80 years old, a grandmother, and, you know, a wonderful, wonderful woman to learn from. And it's her that sort of has this method of using the subconscious mind to interpret the issues that the person's saying. And that way it sort of, it keeps me outside. I'm not sort of mixing my emotional stuff up with the client. You know, they're able to interpret it for themselves. But we better do that. Just to you want, first of all, maybe we'll just show the video, and then maybe because you'll be probably interested to see that yourself.
Yeah, we're going to show a little clip here. So this is just a short excerpt from a video with.
If you want to stop it at any time,
is there any part of it that's particularly crucial towards the beginning, towards the end, anything like that?
I'll just see how it goes. You can speed it up and just get an idea of how it works.
Okay, so this is a session that was done between Dennis and Venerable Chaga quite recently, and Venerable Chaga hasn't yet seen it. So I asked Dennis to whether there was anything, you know, potentially embarrassing in it, and he said no. I said, well, what's the point in showing it then? Anyway, here we go.
He did too. And he's the one that wanted us to do a live session too. This is subtitled so that you can read it. He's very quiet.
I think we have some. looks like for some reason the audio is not working.
I put this onto a stick just to put into this computer, but it looks like the audio hasn't come across. But you can see the subtitles here of what's being said. It was interesting for me with Venerable Chaga because he didn't sort of follow the way that, because we always use metaphor to get people to where they are, but he didn't really follow the metaphor. I usually have a metaphor of a cloud and sort of being on the cloud. You can just watch this as I'm speaking, but so you can see here at this part he's talking about we're in a cupboard, or rather we're in a bedroom that he recognised as his. It was in a set of flats, so I think that you didn't know.
Basically, I'll just give you a bit of background. About 20 years ago,
about
1994, I did a regression with my girlfriend's friend. And it was even up 20 years ago, there was two things that really stood out at that time, and that is, one, what I was feeling, and two, is the potency of the images that I had at that time. So I had sort of a bit of a background of what to expect in regards to that. But what I didn't expect was that the images would change so quickly and so drastically into something completely different.
Is that better?
So basically,
is that better? Okay. So what happened was initially he asked me to get on the cloud and he relaxed me first, which was very nice, and that's why my voice was so low, because I just very relaxed, my body was relaxed, and I didn't feel like speaking too much, so everything was very quiet. And then what happened was he said to me, go on this cloud and come down from the cloud, and I ended up near this little river, or not a river, a lake I should say, with a rock and a tree, and he asked me to look down at my feet and I could just see grass on my feet. Now this is the difference between what I was experiencing and seeing in there and the other part of your mind, which he was just talking about, which was your conscious mind giving some sort of analysis to what's happening, you know. So you have that sort of infiltrating the images at the same time, and I found at that stage I needed to sort of slow it down a bit, but I couldn't articulate that to Dennis because he's just going through the normal procedure, and it wasn't until after the session was finished and I called him a couple of days later and went through it. But basically what happened was I was in there, and then he said to me, get back into the cloud, if I think I remember correctly. And then the next minute, there's an image of just these flats, red flats, and I got to the door of the flats, and the door itself was an image that I think I've seen in Perth. But then the next minute, I was inside the flats, and there's another door there, and it opened, and my mother opened the door. So once she opened the door, I couldn't see her face, I just knew it was my mother. And I don't know whether it was from this life or another life. And I walked in, and it was older sort of 50s, 60s sort of furniture and stuff. She lived on her own. I felt very comfortable there. And I walked in through the house. There was no one to be found. I walked down the hallway in every room. And then I got to this part, which was my bedroom. This is all just feelings, what I was feeling. And when I got there, there was a door which I hadn't seen before, and then that's when we got to this part. So if you play it on, I'll explain to you what happened. And So basically I got to the door, and I opened it was pitch black, but I knew there were some stairs there. So I was just like, yeah buddy, I'm going down there. So I just went straight down these stairs, and next minute I just stopped, and it was complete darkness. And then it started to light up, and I saw these church mosaics right at the back of the altar. And from there, Dennis started asking me questions, you know, what am I wearing? And that's when I got a bit of a clear description. I had a sword. I had these weird shoes on. Winkle picker shoes, a hat. I had a big long nose. So and I remember saying to Dennis that the side of I looked at my shoulder and it was red and white. I can't really explain it. It's like a popcorn bag sort of sticking in my arm, you know, coming out this way. And it was all very strange, but it was very clear, those parts, you know. So he asked me to go from there. Nothing really happened in there, did it, Dennis? It was just the same. I seemed to have some struggles with moving through stuff. So from there, I just went into, he asked me to go to my home. And I think I ended up in some sort of pub. And I sat down and I had a meal. And that's the first time I saw another human being in there who served me the food. And I couldn't see any of these faces except, I'll tell you the two at the end, but I could feel the relationship I had with that person. And it was very friendly. She knew me very well. And I sat there a lot. And I had this sense at that time that I was some sort of official in that town or that area, you know. So that's basically what happened there.
Should I fast forward then?
Yeah. Yeah, it's very strange watching yourself half asleep. And then the last bit was he asked me to go to my death and that life. So the next minute I just saw this image of me lying on the bed, much older, in these raggedy sort of clothes type of thing. And there was two women next to me. One on this side, I was lying this way so my head was here, and one on this side. And initially I couldn't see this face, I could only see the other lady's face. And I didn't know who she was, but again I had that friendliness feeling between both of them. And without going into too much detail about what I saw with them, because it's nothing other than what we see with each other now, so to speak. There was then this moment he said, well, can you go to your last breath? And my mind wouldn't go to the last breath. It went to, like, just a little bit before. That's what it felt like, anyhow. And then the most surprising thing was that there was no fear, nothing like the emotion was very stable. And I said to him, I need to go to the toilet, which was on the bed. And then I said to him, hold on a sec, we need to stop the session. I need to go to the toilet now. And I was bursting, and then the session finished because I didn't need to go to the toilet. So I don't know which way that crossed over, but that's basically what happened, you know. And it was only afterwards, I'm not skeptical about past lives, but I'm skeptical about what I see and experience. So it's only been the last few days that resonance is sort of sitting down with me a bit more, and thinking of what happened 20 years ago, and it's a very similar sort of imagery, you know. So I'll pursue it next week and see what happens. But I hope that was clear enough for you about sort of the experience.
Thanks so much. That's fantastic. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah. I'll just finish off by my saying this. The last statements of General Cargas there has made is probably quite typical, where people do feel sceptical about what they say, or, you know, this is not happening to me, or, you know, why should I believe this? But that's the... Yeah, and there's not really much you can say about that either. I mean, you've got, people either believe something or they don't. But, you know, the way that I think about that myself is that I actually think about this life now, and I think about my memories of yesterday or last year, especially as a child, and I think about that, and then I wonder, you know, well, what's this life about? What does this life mean? You know, are those memories true? And clearly, now from the perspective of Buddhism, I know I know a little bit more about perception now and feelings and how all that works, and how the whole thing can be just totally misjudged. So it's very difficult to sort of know what's true or what isn't true. But in terms of the hypnosis, though, what I have noticed is that when people are able to bring their head, the thinking part of what happens, together with their heart, it's really quite compelling. You know, you can, as I was just telling Venerable before, you see someone sitting here and they're fairly clearly confabulating a story. They're just telling a story. So I'll be lying back telling a story. Oh, yes, I can see the grass. I can see this rock here, and there's a tree over there, and I'm walking up to the tree, and then they'll go, and then there's floods of tears come, you know. So you can clearly see when the intellect kind of meets the heart, and then all of a sudden there's truth. You know, the whole thing has come together. And I guess that's the beauty of sort of doing this kind of work too. It's a way of bringing unity into your body. And in fact, that's what Nibbana is itself anyway, isn't it? That we're unifying, balancing ourselves. So,
just on what Dennis was saying, now I spoke to somebody recently who had the same regression past life with Dennis, and I told him what my concerns was, and surprisingly he said exactly the same with his. And so that gave me a bit more confidence about what I was experiencing. But one of the things I did notice in there is that a lot of it is just letting go. You know, so you're in there, it's pretty similar to meditation, you know, you're in there and you've got these conflicting things going on, and you're just trying to let it rest. And I clearly feel what Dennis was saying is that there was this subconscious mind which was creating the images, or the images were coming from there, and it was my conscious mind, as I said earlier, that was giving reference to it, you know. But then sometimes it would just give a clear reference and that was it. But then there's other times when doubt would come in, you know, oh, I've seen this image before, this and that. And then it would unsettle it slightly. And at that particular moment, that's when I knew I needed just to settle down for a second before it kicked off again, you know. So that's sort of like the process it was for me as a patient.
Thank you so much to both Dennis and Venerable Chaga.
And Alan, too.
And Alan, yeah.
He didn't know you were going to do that.
we sprung that on him. Fascinating stories, and, you know, particularly for me, it's very interesting to hear that kind of the way that these experiences happen in a kind of on a kind of balance or edge between what is subjective and what is objective, and those two things always interplaying, and never, it's been difficult to discern. But I guess one, for yourself as a therapist, the important thing that the person feels better, right? That they come out feeling more emotionally whole, and our minds have all kinds of different ways of making sense of things. Yeah?
It's cathartic, yeah.
So, but also, you know, if in cases where, you know, specific details are mentioned, if it's possible to go back and actually check them and verify them, then that's fantastic to be able to do that as well. Yeah. Right.
What I wanted to ask was, in your experience, has when people are reborn, is it in a linear passage through time, or do people jump back and forward through lives in different stages of history? Like, has anyone had a past life regression that sounded futuristic, or that kind of thing? Or even if it wasn't on Earth, like on another planet or something that was completely...
That would not be a past life then.
Well, it would for them if their soul was like... That's the question.
Yeah, good question, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, the fact is that's... You know, I have had a few people that have had experiences in sort of crystal universes and, you know, weird things like that. And just going on from Ajahn Brahm's talk, for those that were here for that wonderful talk on Friday night that he gave, you know, I think these sorts of things can happen. And I mean, I don't know whether a crystal universe might be true or not, but this chap felt he was sort of trapped here and was sort of taken back to some kind of future world like that. So, yeah, that happens. But the other thing I was just going to point to here, though, is this wonderful lady called Jenny Cockell. You're familiar with this lady? There's on my website, I've got a whole lot of videos on rebirth. This Jenny Cockell, this book here is called Future Lies, so she's thinking about that. But she's really quite a remarkable woman in the way that she sees things. She actually had a past life in Ireland, and she died having her, I think it was a seventh child. And so there was, and she knew that when she died, she had a bit of a wastrel of a husband who used to beat her and so on. So she knew those children weren't going to, she knew they'd go to an orphanage. And she's my age now, actually. She lives in Northamptonshire, this lady. And she had these feelings of something was wrong right from the time that she was born. She was having these dreams about children and so on, but ended up going and having hypnosis. And cutting a long story short, she went back to Ireland, found the home where she lived in there, found the hospital where she died, and then also, because she was only young, she was able to find the children, the actual children that she'd had. And she was able to tell that family that they had another child that they didn't even know that was part of the family, because they'd all got split up, of course, in the end and went to orphanages. But, a remarkable person. She's been able to remember also a life as a samurai. And I know Japanese television had her over into Japan. But the story wasn't quite as compelling as the one that she had from Ireland. But nonetheless, it was still, many, many loose ends tying up. Just really quite astonishing.
Okay, thanks for that. Just on that, the future thing, I'm not aware of that in the context of past lives and so on, but there was some research on dreaming which suggested that we dream about the future about as often as we dream about the past. Yeah, so...
I've got a question. With these past life regressions, do people, because you mentioned people being embodied in animals, so given that it's so difficult to have a human rebirth, do many of these, or any of these, have a recall of a life as an animal or in another realm, like a Deva realm or a hell realm?
My experience with that really is more... The people that I've had with that, when they've had, they've seen themselves as animals, they've really more been, I'm not really quite sure about these, because they've really more been dancing bears and things like that, so you kind of know that there's a whole lot of emotional content behind what they're talking about. But they're certainly able to feel the pain of the bear and the, but I haven't really had anyone that's sort of gone back to be a frog or an ant or anything like that, really. It's not yet, anyway.
Yeah, and that's fairly characteristic of like children with past life memories and so on, that's fairly rare that you have memories of an animal birth, yeah.
I have one technical question. What's the name of the technique used when it came up? Who structured this technique, and what are the other alternative techniques that can be followed? And why the background for this question, that I watched once an interview with a guy who follows a different approach. He tries to suggest mind to go back in time, so he brings the person to when year 5, year 2, year 1, and then year 0, and definitely you see someone in a almost unconscious state, and then he tried to suggest year minus something, and somehow he does not believe in rebirth, so he tries to read deep layers of the conscious or the person's mind, but I could not understand what technique it was that he didn't give a name, so I would like to know if that's a different thing, and what's your technique, something like that.
Yeah, I think that sort of you've got to be very careful, and you've got to be quite ethical too when you're doing this kind of work, because it is very easy to plant suggestions into people's minds. Very, very easy to do, as I think the whole psychological world knows that now. So, but there are different techniques, and sometimes techniques like that are quite good when you can maybe talk to somebody, make them very relaxed, and then just, it's more or less like a shock technique where you'll just say, okay, now what do you think about this when you're 5? Just 5, and then there'll be a thought that'll sort of come into the person's head that is sometimes relevant to what the therapy might be aiming towards. But as I say, my technique, I like Dolores Cannon's method, but I've also been with Brian Weiss. I mean, many people here would be familiar with Brian Weiss, no doubt, and all his books. Yeah, a fantastic psychiatrist, actually. He was at the Mount Sinai Hospital. But he's really a wonderful hypnotherapist. And I've also, I'm familiar with the Newton's techniques of past lives between lives. They have a technique there. Those techniques didn't really interest me as much, so because they weren't so, I didn't resonate as much with Buddhism. You know, I mean, my whole approach probably is comes from a Buddhist perspective, and it's that's really why I like Dolores's method so much, because it's well, it just keeps me out of the mix. You know, it keeps my, you know, my thoughts about, you know, or interpretations about what's happening out of it, so that it, you leave the interpretations up to the client.
Okay. So, yes, Wayne?
It's a question to the Venables. Do you believe this, being hypnotised into this state, to be a true, one of the three knowledges, as Lord Buddha said, to really be at that level, with that implication?
Do you want to take that, or do you want me? Okay. I think, well, I think it's, so we mentioned in the a little bit earlier that when the Buddha recollected his past lives, he was what we call the Teviyajar, three knowledges. First knowledge is the recollection of past lives. Second knowledge is the seeing of beings passing away and being reborn according to their karma. And the third knowledge is the knowledge of the ending of all defilements. That's enlightenment. Now, clearly these kinds of memories, whether from hypnosis, whether from spontaneous childhood memories and so on, clearly it's in a similar sphere or similar field to that knowledge in, as the three knowledges. But with the Teviyajar, the three knowledges is always the outcome of fourth jhana. Okay, so it's the outcome of an extremely profound state of mind. Now, in these kind of states of mind that you get through hypnosis and so on, then obviously you can get some peace, you can get some clarity, you can access some memories and ideas and so on that you wouldn't normally get to, but it's a long way from the profundity of fourth jhana. And so what that means is that the clarity of knowledge is far less. Right? So fourth jhana, there's no defilements, no hindrances, nothing. The mind's completely bright and clear. And so, you know, these kinds of use of symbolism and metaphor and confusion and being able to discern these different kinds of things, and that's all gone. It's like you've just stepped out into the bright sunshine of midday and you just see that's what it is. And the description of that knowledge is always very clear. I was born in such and such a place, that was my name, that was what I ate, this is what I did, this was what my family was. So there's no sort of question of interpretation or anything. It's just plainly and clearly seeing exactly what happened. So I think that what we're seeing here is kind of, if you like, less clear, less precise, and less certain approximation of that same kind of knowledge. Yeah.
Thank you.
Probably. Is this a contradiction of Ujjhupatipanna?
What, sorry?
Is this a contradiction of not following, getting certain thing by not following the correct path, like Ujjhupatipanna?
Oh, you think you're taking a shortcut?
Yes.
Yeah? Dennis, are you leading people astray by taking them on shortcuts?
Well, no, it's a good thought, actually, too. I think that this is very valid. Hypnosis is obviously very different than meditation. You know, meditation, you're totally aware. In hypnosis, it is more a dream state. It's not a you're approaching the subconscious, but it's more like, you know, when you're waking up in the morning. So, you know, for me, it's maybe 4 o'clock or so in the morning when you're starting to come up again. There's these images and thoughts coming, and sometimes you remember them, sometimes you don't. That's more like a hypnosis state. It's not really full awareness, but of course meditation, you're totally aware, fully aware. But I think there is something you can say about that with the hypnosis though too, and because I'm actually playing around with experimenting with ideas of actually developing stillness with hypnosis, so being able to help people develop a still mind with hypnosis, so taking them to there and then taking them to that still place and then asking the mind, the subconscious mind, to remember it so that you can take it back. And I think that when you're kind of thinking about it from a Buddhist perspective, and perhaps it comes to a little bit of a question that Alan asked before too, just where are these memories stored? if there are memories, where are they stored? Well, I think they are stored in the conscious field, the consciousness field. It comes back to the five khandhas again. And if you come right back to the pure consciousness, the pure consciousness before there's really any movement in that consciousness. You know, it's really right in that consciousness that we're the whole of our stream of the stream of energy that we've got, or the stream of consciousness that we all attach to. That's really where it lives. It lives in that consciousness that pervades the whole universe. And you know, so I think you can, you know, you don't have to see it as a as a bad thing necessarily. It can be very helpful for Buddhism.
So in short, what you are saying is that it's not a contradiction or a shortcut, but it's clearing the path towards the right path.
I think it can be. Yeah.
Thank you.
Maybe. Do you want to, oh, sorry.
I'd like to ask a question if I can. Is this working? Okay. I think it's working. I think one of the strengths of the past life recollection, as I see it in the suttas, which makes it very believable, is that you have it's a very clear kind of sequence of cause and effect. So you live in the past life and you see kind of your past life evolving, and you come to the point of death. And actually, it says in the standard formula for recollection of past lives, you die in that life and then you get reborn in this life, right? So you see actually how the past life connect directly with this life here. And that kind of, you actually relive, in a sense, that whole experience. Is that something you have found in your work as well?
Absolutely. That's really just really how it is. When I was talking before about those memories connecting, when the head and the heart come together and there's kind of truth in the moment, there's something quite... It's just astonishing sort of being with someone when they sort of go into a state like that, because it's just so... It just feels so truthful. I don't know, it's sort of getting off the path, but I can remember this once, this man who... He was a homosexual man, and he was quite comfortable with that, of course, too. He had no problems with that, but he wanted to know certain questions about why he was attracted to different people and why he was attracted to this one particular place in Europe, in Germany in particular. And anyway, he ended up with this woman in England, and he could remember this life as a woman. And it was just... I was watching him in the chair and, you know, just going to your point, it was almost like he was talking about his sexuality, and he was talking, you know, the dress that she had on and the way that she was lying there, and just the feelings that he felt for this man. It was a very sensual kind of a moment, but it was almost as if he turned into that woman. You know, I was looking at him, he was that woman. It was just astonishing to see, you know, how it was being relived in that way. And yeah.
I just would like to confirm that this connection between past life and current life. Although my recollection was somewhere in France, or 11th, 12th century, it had definitely relevance to something in my current life. And this is something which is really, which shocked me. You say, wow, after, 900 years, it's still something which happened then, is still relevant today. And that's really, really astonishing.
Well, I think that's what Venerable Murali likes to see too, isn't it? That resonance, because that's really how it happens. There is that resonance that just sort of, you lose it, never seems to get rid of it. And I think that's really when the First Noble Truth really starts to stand out for you. You know, you start to see the dukkha in the way that we're just reliving old patterns all the time. You know, it's...
Okay. Thank you so much, Dennis, and Venerable Jag, and Alan, for that. That's very, very interesting. And what I'd like to do now is... we can break up and have our discussion session for the next, maybe we'll do 45 minutes discussion session, and as I'm sure you're familiar with the drill by now, so we'll break up into different groups, maybe about four or five different groups around the room. And what I'd like to bring up in this discussion is, what's your story Do you remember your past lives? Did somebody in your family, a friend that you know, or any other events and things? What we did this last week in Sydney, it was quite astonishing to find actually most people, when you dug down a bit, had some kind of story to tell. So, of course, you know, we don't want you to, you know, to feel uncomfortable about, you know, sharing your story. If you feel like it's very personal and you don't want to share it, then that's fine. You don't have to talk about your story. I mean, merely the fact that if you do talk about it, you will help many other people to get enlightened and to escape from suffering. Yeah. So if you want to be selfish and to not share your story, that's perfect. That's just up to you. I don't want to judge or put any pressure on you, right? We can all choose to be selfish if we like. That's fine. No, I'm only kidding, kind of, mostly. And so, but anyway, so look, let's break and just, you know, talk about how these things impact us. We've looked at, you know, some of the examples of evidence. We'll be looking at more later. But what we've also seen is something about some kind of sense of emotional connection. And that's something which is very powerful. And we'll see that later with the children's recollections. That there's some kind of emotional resonance there. And so anyway, let's break up into groups and let's have to talk about that. And let's remember that when we're doing these groups, that it's our opportunity to practice part of the path, practice samavacha, is right speech, to practice dhamma sakacchara, is discussion on dhamma. And with discussion on dhamma, part of it is talking. When we talk, then we will make an endeavor to speak clearly, right? To articulate what we have to say using no more words than is necessary, yeah? And with a thought of compassion for the people who are listening and trying to understand what we're saying. And when we're listening, we'll pay attention to what people are saying. We will also have a special notice for people in the group who maybe are quiet or shy or reluctant to speak, and we'll gently encourage those people to speak so that the group isn't dominated by one or two people who have lots to say. Okay, so this is all part of the practice and part of what we're doing. Learning to articulate your own experience and your own understanding is a part of the Eightfold Path. So let's take the opportunity to develop the Eightfold Path. Okay, let's go.